Welcome to Barry Maguire's Tales from the Trenches, real life stories of Canadian real estate investors. Learn more at www.barrymaguire.ca.
This is a great story about writing your first creative real estate deal, the importance of diligence in making that buying decision, deciding to pull the trigger, and nine lessons learned that came out of this deal. It all started after my recent focus workshop on the creative seller financing technique called Agreements for Sale. After the workshop, one of the attendees called me up, told me he had done some marketing and he had a possibility. I said, guess what? Marketing works. My client's marketing got a call from some folks who were trying to live their dream. They wanted to build a spa in a on an acreage, a rural area near Edmonton. That was their dream, and they got a mortgage from TD Bank, and they started building, and about three quarters of the way through, they ran out of money. And there was no way to get any more money. They tried everything they could, but it just wasn't working. At the point they made the call to my client, they were 5 months in arrears on their mortgage, and TD Bank, who was the lender, had actually sent it to foreclosure. The TD Bank's lawyers had the paperwork, and they'd issued foreclosure papers, which was well in progress. These folks, let's call them the spa folks, were desperate. They were at their wits' end. They tried everything. They were at the point where a lot of motivated sellers get to. They'd just given up. They just wanted out. And so they were hoping that my client could help them. Now, conversations ensued. It looked like if the property was fixed up and if all of the construction was done and the landscape was completed, that there would be an after repaired value, or ARV, ARV, of about $100,000 over the cost of getting it to that stage. So that had some possibilities and had our client thinking. His first thought was to purchase the property by way of agreement for sale, which is, as I said, seller financing technique. Title remains in the seller's name. They lend you a chunk of money, in this case probably equal to the mortgage. We didn't know whether that was going to work in this case, so my client found some JV partners, some joint venture partners, one set of partners to deal with finding contractors and supervising the renovation and doing that sort of thing, another set of joint venture partners who would come up with all the money. Already a little complicated, that's what ran through my mind. Now, money to complete was, I think it was $20,000 to stop the foreclosure, $30,000 to finish the home and the landscaping. Then there were going to be closing costs and miscellaneous costs. Yeah, and it looked like it was going to be about an after repaired value of $100,000 over all the expenses. Now, I said this was going to be a joint venture, and so who's getting what out of this joint venture? Well, the spa folks really didn't care if they got anything, but in the end, they were going to get 20% of whatever the profit was on this deal. That leaves 80%, and that was going to be divided 50-50 between the two sets of joint venture partners. That would be my client and the folks who were going to find the contractor and supervise the renovation, and the money folks who are going to come up with all the cash, money partners, they're going to get the other 40%. Now, a little sidebar here. By the time my client gave me a call, he'd already started the ball rolling. He was pretty far along in getting costs and numbers and people to work with, and had the whole deal pretty well outlined, and he'd put it into this thing called a letter of intent. Now, a letter of intent is a really important document, I think, in creative real estate. It's a document in letter format, as you would think from the name, letter of intent. And it's one or two pages long. It's not long. It's written in plain English. It basically tells the story of the proposed joint venture. Here's the deal. Here's the parties in the deal. Here's how we think the deal is going to go. Here's how the profit's going to be split and who does what. It is a non-binding document. In other words, it's not a contract. What it does is it makes people think about the deal and organize their thoughts and get them down on paper. So if you look at a letter of intent, a short letter of intent, one or two pages, and it doesn't make crystal clear sense to you as you read it, then it's not a good letter of intent. You have to polish that up until you can take it and give it to your probably partners and say, you know, we've been talking about all this stuff, lots of talking. I've now put it down on paper. Here it is. So I think letters of intent are hugely important in especially creative deals. And in this case, my client's letter of intent was pretty good. We did a little bit of polishing on it, and he'd presented it to his partners and got agreement. So always remember, use a letter of intent. With the letter of intent written and a conditional real estate purchase contract, or offer to purchase as we often call it, now written, it was time to look at some of the details. And those details really are diligence. And the biggest diligence items were, how much was it really going to cost for a contractor to come and finish the home? Number two, foreclosure costs were an estimate. And so we needed a written statement from the foreclosure lawyer, and then marketing research. Were our numbers realistic? So that was the next step, get going on these three items. First thing my client found out about was the foreclosure. Remember, the estimate was $20,000. When we got a written statement, got to have a written statement, it turned out to be $30,000 at the point in time when the lawyer wrote the letter. And remember, costs are always increasing with foreclosure lawyers. So here's a sidebar on foreclosures. Foreclosures are an interesting investment opportunity for creative real estate investors. But what we found over the years is that it is very, very difficult to get any kind of a handle on foreclosure costs until you get that written statement. You can check with the bank before it's in, you know, official foreclosure. You can ask the homeowner and try and look at their paperwork. But really, nothing works until you get the written statement, which includes all of the latest costs, including property managers, including the lawyer's fees, which can be substantial. And so in conclusion, if you're looking at a foreclosure, don't do anything till you have a written statement. This bit of bad news, that the foreclosure was going to cost at least $10,000 more, was the start of this whole project going in the wrong direction. And in the end, the deal collapsed. And when it collapsed, I emailed my client and I said, you put a lot of effort into this and I know you learned a lot. How about emailing me back and telling me, you know, what your three most important things, or what were the three things you learned out of this? My client emailed me back and he said, Barry, I didn't learn three things. I learned at least six things, and here they are. Number one. Maybe before number one, I saw this as a huge learning process and very important for my creative real estate. But really, on the actual issues, number one was risk about the fact that it was an acreage. When I started doing diligence, I realized that it isn't as easy to flip a house, an acreage house, as it is a house in the city. Number two, further risk, that if it was hard to sell and if I couldn't sell, then I was going to have to rent it, and I couldn't get real hard facts on what acreages would rent for. So I didn't really know what my exit strategy would be if it didn't sell. Number three, the financing and profit numbers were ending up to be too tight. It started out that we thought it would be about $100,000 profit, but when we added $10,000 for foreclosure, The contractor costs were going to be $45,000 when we got the written estimate, not $30,000. And then we did some diligence on the title and found that rural electrification lien that was another $10,000. Now our $100,000 is down to $65,000. So the profit split is 20-40-40, and all of a sudden that is too tight. The more we looked at the deal, the costs were going up and some of the issues were getting larger. And of course, I had to take into account this truth about renovations. Renovations, no matter where you're doing them or why you're doing them, you can count on actual costs being higher than even careful estimates, because people write estimates and they try and take into account the fact that costs will be higher. A project always takes longer to finish, it takes longer to sell, and it sells for less. So that's a little sidebar on renovations, but that really turned our $100,000 into looking more like $50,000 and split three ways. Not going so well. Number four, I had pointed out to my client that even if the mortgage was brought into good standing, the term of the mortgage had already expired, and there was no guarantee that the lender was going to renew for any substantial term, which left the agreement for sale financing technique at risk, and one that I would have a hard time recommending. So that would have left our clients looking to get a new mortgage, which also would take more time, more money, and was uncertain. Three people splitting the profits was number five. That was getting re-emphasized. The finder, who was supposed to help with getting the contractor and supervising the renovations, in the end couldn't find an appropriate contractor, and the contractor who came up with the actual cost was one that our client found. And so our client's going, if they couldn't even find a contractor, I'm going to end up supervising this job and managing construction and landscaping, and I'd end up running the whole project times money. If I had to supervise, first, I didn't have the time, and second, my portion of that diminishing profit number is going to become smaller because I wouldn't get paid for my time. And lastly, number six, on the money partner side, they had a realtor that they wanted to use, and he was a city realtor with no experience in acreages. And so our client was getting forced into using a realtor that wasn't appropriate. You really need to have the right realtor for the right area and who has the right tools. I guess the last one was that my client had a friend who was also an investor and ran a real estate company. He talked to his friend, ran the numbers by and the scenario by them, and the friend said, I don't have a good feeling in my stomach about this, which was just how my client was feeling at that point in time. So that was really the end of the email. All those reasons were why the deal didn't go ahead. Now, we're going to talk about and review those lessons learned in a minute, but if you've been to one of my focus workshops, you know my goal is to have all attendees do, wait for it, one damn deal. Because if you can do one deal, you can do more. That first deal is the hardest and the most important one. But backdrop to that is you don't want that first deal to be a bad deal. And in this particular scenario, my client was initially very enthusiastic, but analysis and diligence proved that the deal would chew up time and resources, and they really weren't going to make any money. So that's a bad deal. All right, let's get on to those amazing lessons learned, and there are nine of them. Often we only have three, but there's nine in this one. So number one, get started on a deal. Plunge in, make a conditional offer. You can't learn about real estate of any kind, let alone creative real estate, if you don't at least write a deal. On creative deals, early in the process, clarify that deal with a letter of intent. Number three, Stopping foreclosures is always, always more than what your estimate will be. Number four, any renovation always takes longer, costs more, takes longer to market, and sells for less. Number five, your protection in any creative deal is the gap between your after repaired value and the estimated costs. Got to have a big enough gap so that it can stand some shrinkage. Number six, diligence protects you from making bad decisions. Number seven, if you're shaky at all on a deal, and even if you're really happy about it, get a second opinion from a trusted mentor that can give you another perspective and help confirm what's going on. Number eight, too many partners means smaller profit, and it's hard to get a consensus or to get enough authority so that you're the one making all the decisions. And lastly, you probably know what this one is. Don't force the opportunity. Walk if your diligence says no, and use your experience to write up another deal.
Thanks for listening to Barry Maguire's Tales from the Trenches. Get the inside scoop on real estate investing from one of Canada's foremost real estate lawyers. To print this tale and for more valuable investing insights, go to www.barrymaguire.ca.